and Larry Meyer. Wait a minute. Larry Meyer wouldn't be here for this. All right, agenda item. Thank you for your letter.
I don't know.
Okay.
We'll see.
Well, we'll see. Okay. Susan McDonald?
I'm Susan McDonald, MCDONALD. I live in Cambria on a 303 delisted creek. My neighbors are farmers, but in my opinion, being near a listed water body does not automatically mean that they are causing or adding to that water body's impairment. If there's no runoff of fertilizer or pesticides, farming can be done safely. Farmers in my area have changed their irrigation practices to prevent runoff. They use cover crops as insurance to protect water quality. Location, I believe, without consideration of farm management practices, should not be used to bump an ag operation up to a higher tier. There's also some question about the criteria being used to define impaired water bodies under this order. Table 1 in Appendix A provides the 2010 Clean Water Act Section 303 delist for toxicity, pesticides, nutrients, temperature, turbidity, and sediment. I'm wondering, are water bodies that are 303 delisted for E. coli and other indicator bacteria not associated with irrigated ag, are they also a trigger for Tier 2 and Tier 3? If that's the case, it seems like mixing apples and oranges to me. The criteria for irrigated ag should be based on discharges actually made by irrigated ag. Finally, agriculture is not responsible for all the constituent pollutants found in local watersheds. Yet agriculture is being ordered to clean up pollutants without any delineation between ag discharges and those coming from other sources, particularly urban lawns, landscape, and gardens. Homeowners use many of the same fertilizers, pesticides, yet agriculture is being targeted. The goal is to improve water quality, but fairness must be a part of the equation. I support the Farmers for Water Quality terms and conditions for compliance through a third-party group as a way to accomplish both. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. And by the way, E. coli is not on the radar for this.
It's not.
It's not.
Good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Kay Mercer.
Hello, I'm Kay Mercer, and that's K M-E-R-C-E-R. And thank you for allowing me to come and speak for you. Wanted to talk about the draft ag waiver and the top three issues that I see with the current draft that is before you. The first is that it's really not solution-focused. It is a regulation, but there's not a lot of solutions offered in the regulation. I think it is a big improvement over what we had in 2010. However, it's overcomplicated, and it's doubtful whether it can be administered or enforced by staff. In fact, I'm not sure it's implementable at all. I do want to talk about anomalies. Robert Dolezal talked to you about groundwater nitrate in March. I'd like to talk about a couple of other situations in the draft order where there's anomalies, omissions, and some errors. First, I'd like to talk about the list of pesticides. There's 84 pesticides that are listed. This is finding 68 in the draft order. First of all, staff, it's obvious they haven't really consulted with EPA, DPR, and Department of Fish and Game. They're not taking into account the amount of environmental fate work and toxicological work that's done by those agencies when these pesticides are registered. Second of all, in terms of the list itself, I was kind of shocked when I first looked at it because many of the pesticides that are on the list aren't ag chemicals. Some of them are tomaticides, which means they're used to control termites. They're roadside herbicides. They're not used by ag. Some are not registered in California. Some are registered in California but aren't used on the Central Coast. So out of the 84 pesticides, 13 of the active ingredients are used on approximately 80% of the crops. Only 13 of the 84 are used on 80% of the crops on the Central Coast. 52 of those are included in DPR's ongoing surface water monitoring program. 37 are included in DPR's pesticide management zones, which includes a permit and covers a specific geographical area. 13 of those 84% are DPR restricted use pesticides, which require a permit. So what's the solution to this? Instead of just saying, you use this product, therefore you're in a certain tier, it really should have some risk assessment involved with it. You know, I heard someone say, use agronomy. I mean, agronomy applies here. Where is the product being used? What crop is it being used on? When is it being used? Why is it being used? How is it being used? How much is being used? What's the soil type? What's the hydromorphology? All of those things, what's happening in the watershed? All of those things go into that.
Can you wrap up?
I can wrap up.
One sentence.
Your list of impaired water bodies is impaired itself.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments.
Do you want to hear about the impairments, just real quick?
Not unless someone wants to ask you.
Yeah, I want to hear it.
Particularly since it applies to Santa Cruz County, out of the 29 impaired water bodies that are on the list, I read the TMDL reports for the sediment and nutrient. Out of those, 12 do not attribute sediment or turbidity or nutrients to irrigated ag. So you have 12 water bodies that don't even have irrigated ag on there, and there are no attributions to irrigated ag. I did a used integrated report from the State Water Resources Control Board and did a visual inspection of the remaining, all 99 water bodies. The other 17 in Santa Cruz County that remain on the list, only 15 of those had any measurable irrigated ag. 15 had no measurable irrigated ag. The two that remained that actually had any measurable irrigated ag, one had 5%, one had 7%. So what happens is you have growers. You might have some great grower up in Santa Cruz Hills that is now on an impaired water body that has no appreciable irrigated ag that's instantly in tier two. And so, or maybe even in tier three, depending on what pesticides you guys decide to make a tiering criteria. And so all of a sudden, your own reports say that irrigated ag is not a source of impairment, and then you turn around and list these water bodies as impaired and make it a criteria in a regulation for irrigated ag. Thank you.
Thank you. Larry Meyer, not here. Chris O'Connor. Barbara Ann Ogle. And then Dana Pearls. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Chris O'Connor, K-R-I-S-O apostrophe C-O-N-N-O-R with the Central Coast Vineyard Team. I want to thank you for the latest draft and including SIP certified growers in the Tier 1 category. We certainly appreciate this recognition, but in accordance with our previous letters, we still believe that there are many operations that are not certified that do not pose threats to water quality. In the May board workshop here in San Luis Obispo, the direction was clear. Create an order that both incentivizes practices and rewards growers. But nevertheless, the current framework still presumes that ag operators are polluters, that they're guilty until they can prove they're innocent. This draft continues to apply a point source regulatory model for a non-point source program. But really, if we were looking at an incentivizing approach that actually protected water quality, like some of the previous speakers, we would be looking at actual risk. We would have tiers that had triggers that actually growers had control over and that related to risk and help protect water quality. In that way, you would incentivize people to adopt things, keep the water clean, and move into different tiers. In May, the board also provided direction to not require more information that can be managed or analyzed. I would really disagree with some of the slides that say that the current draft is actually less burdensome than the current waiver. It's just not true. So there's a lot of work required by this proposal, and people should be paying attention to that. Again, In May, one of the directions was to not use the 303D list because I think I had in my notes somebody said, you know, it's too broad. And but still this 100, you know, nearly 100 water body list is still in there as a trigger. You know, and I don't really consider 100 water bodies as being sort of priority for the area if we're really going to focus our attentions. So despite the May direction to focus on surface water and nitrates and organophosphates, this latest draft continues to include riparian areas, stormwater, and groundwater. It seems that although some things get taken out in the new drafts, that more things get included. There was some language around stormwater, as was mentioned by a previous grower, that was actually very contradictory between paragraphs and quite a bit confusing. We're also concerned about the tier trigger, about the possibility of including more pesticides as this tier trigger. Again, in March, some of the language was used interchangeably between sort of detection and toxicity, and we'd really encourage the board to, you know, look at Sarah Green's memo that she provided from Preservation Inc. and become and make sure that we're talking in the appropriate language. So again, I would also like to remind you that you know, that the material does not really equate to risk, that really we have to be looking at transport also. So, you know, the Vineyard team has obviously has done a lot of work in this issue. We continue to want to work with the staff and the board to try to come up with a solution to protect water quality. We're happy to be a resource. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Barbara Ann Ogle. Dana Pearls.
Hi, Dana.
Hi. So Steve Shimek, S-H-I-M-E-K, and I have a letter from Pesticide Watch Environmental Fund. Before I begin, though, I would like to mention the fact that you asked the question about if anybody knows about the LGMA and buffers. Yeah, it came up in during the CDFA's presentation. I actually met with LGMA about buffers, and there is a requirement about buffers. They asked the question, and they asked if anyone had information to please say.
Here to read statement,
Steve.
And other people did.
Yeah. But you know what? Just stick to the. You're here speaking. You're giving someone else's comments. So if someone had asked you for specific questions, that would be different.
So the only person... Okay,
you're here to speak, to give comments for Pesticide Watch.
Right.
Dana Pearls. Please give us those comments.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Jeffries?
Does Mr. Shimek have a card that he's going to speak on behalf of himself?
No, I do not.
No,
I spoke before.
He spoke in Watson.
Right. I just was trying to answer the question that the panel had asked.
Right, but it was asked of someone else. So I'm not going to... It wasn't an open invitation for everyone else.
Actually, it was when you asked.
Well, all right, Steve.
No,
let's do this.
Yeah.
I'm setting this back to 3 minutes.
Right.
We're going to start over. Give me Dana Pearl's comments.
All right. My name is Steve Shimek, and I am speaking on behalf of Dana Pearls, Pesticide Watch Education Fund. The 2011 draft order is an improvement on the 2004 conditional waiver, which did not prioritize water quality requirements and did not contain any compliance or verification monitoring provisions. However, PWEF is very disappointed that in spite of the immense evidence of human health and drinking water concerns from contaminated groundwater, the 2011 draft order remains significantly weaker than it could be. PWEF is concerned that the only toxic pesticides which are being considered are diazinon and chlorpyrifos. While these two commonly used pesticides, which may affect groundwater contamination, the number of pesticides which may be severely contaminated is significant. Rather than only considering two pesticides, there needs to be a more comprehensive list of pesticides which applies to all areas. Bullet point two, and I'm summarizing, surface water and ag runoff should test for numerous pesticides as indicators of what will likely end up in the groundwater. Bullet point three, methyl iodide, a newly registered pesticide, should be included in this list of runoff contaminants. Bullet point four, The criteria for tiering must include groundwater nitrate and pesticide contamination as a factor. We urge you to take timely action to put in place strict requirements for irrigated agricultural discharges so that California residents and water is truly protected and restored. Dana Pearls.
Thank you for your comments. Susan Petrovich, I understand she's not here. Is there anybody from the Santa Barbara County Cattlemen's Association speaking on her, on their behalf? Okay, Richard Quant, then Bill Ritz, Keith Roberts.
I have the PowerPoint presentation.
Okay.
Thank you. On behalf of Farmers for Water Quality, my name is Richard Quant, Quandt. I'm president of the Grower Shipper Association. I have 9 slides that I would like to summarize in terms of estimated cost of meeting the monitoring and reporting requirements for Tier 3 farmers under staff's March proposal. Next slide, please. This slide is, we first reviewed DPR and Ag Commissioner pesticide use reports to determine the number of farms that fell within Tier 3. The 2 criteria we used was 1,000 acres of vegetables and strawberries, and we broke it down by county. The second criteria was discharging to an impaired water body and using the pesticide chlorpyrifos and diazinon. You can see the results of the calculations. We're calculating about 325 of the approximately 1,600 dischargers would fall within Tier 3, representing 219,000 acres, which is about 53% of the total irrigated acres in the region. Next slide, please. We did try to estimate the Tier 3 enrollment cost. This was based on a summary of interviews with Tier 3 growers. We developed a range, and you can see the range is 25,000 to 30,000 per operation. Next slide, please. We also looked at the annual cost of meeting the monitoring and reporting requirements in the order. You can see the main components of that deal with the surface water discharge monitoring requirements and the reporting requirements under the annual compliance plan. Our data indicated there would be a range of between $6,000 and $9,000 per year per Tier 3 grower. Next slide, please. In terms of one expense not summarized in the previous slide is the 30-foot vegetative buffers that Tier 3 growers would have to install for operations located on or adjacent an impaired water body. Next slide, please. We determined there's approximately 6,870 acres in crop production that would be lost. In many cases, the loss would be more than 30 feet because many fields are narrow and irregular, and they follow the contours of the natural water body. In certain cases, 25% of a field would be lost. This slide attempts to show some examples of that. Next slide, please. There are also perennial crops that may have to be moved from the vegetative buffers. We calculated a loss for avocado growers of between 5,000 and 6,000 per tree, and for removal and relocation of vineyards, between 3,700 and 1,100 per acre. Thank you. Next slide, please. I'm going pretty fast. In terms of the conflicts with food safety, in likelihood with these vegetative buffers, most of the leafy green growers would have to install fencing that we calculated at $82 million. And the last slide, please.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Quant.
Thank you.
I just have a question, though. It was my understanding that staff was not proposing that any trees get removed if they're in the buffer. Is that correct or not? No, I'm asking staff. Mr. Quant is concerned.
Yes, that is
correct.
And we've said it multiple times.
Okay. What about with vineyards and vines? Would they have to be removed if they're in that buffer zone?
The water quality buffer, for example, Angela Schroeder. The water quality buffer plan is about addressing the discharge. There's no requirement to remove anything within that area if they can address the discharge. Trees don't need to be removed, vineyards don't need to be removed if they can if they can control the discharge, and that's part of their plan.
There's no requirement to remove.
Speak into the microphone.
There's no requirement to remove vineyards or trees in orchards.
Okay.
There is no requirement.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Quant. Bill Ritz.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Board. My name is Bill Ritz. That's R-I-T-Z. Like a cracker? Okay. Well, levity might help. I'm district representative for State Senator Anthony Cannella. Previously worked for Senator Denham. State Senator Cannella is Senator of District 12, and part of your region falls within his district, which would be part of Monterey County and San Benito County. Senator is also the Senate Chairman of the Agricultural Committee. I just have a few comments from Senator Cannella. It would seem that all sides of this issue agree that clean water and healthy environment are in everyone's best interest. And it is essential that a collaborative effort between the board, staff, the ag community, appropriate agencies, all parties, must occur to develop a reasonable long-term solution. Communities such as Monterey County are extremely dependent.
Give them some additional time.
I won't even take up the 3 minutes, but communities such as Monterey County are extremely dependent on the agricultural industry to maintain a vital economy, create jobs, and to grow healthy produce that feeds not only California, the United States, but is shipped around the world. Increasing levels of regulation and mitigation will threaten this very important industry in our area. Senator Cannella has previously submitted written comments to you urging the board to closely examine all alternatives, such as the agriculture alternative conditional waiver. And finally, a regulation of this magnitude deserves that negotiations include all stakeholders to create a plan of sound science and achievable goals. On behalf of Senator Cannella, I thank you for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. A few questions for you, Mr. Ritz.
Yes.
If you don't have a position on this, that's fine, but I'm just kind of curious.
Okay.
Or the senator. With respect to the groundwater monitoring component, does your office have any?
I couldn't answer that. I'd have to get information
right,
on that.
Okay. And how about for any of the other specific components, you know, that are part of the order? Has your office looked at?
I can't answer that. I'd have to go and ask the senator directly.
Okay.
The message that I bring today is that we continue to look at this in a collaborative manner, all sides, all parties. That's what he wanted to bring forth.
Okay.
As far as those issues, I can certainly get those answered for you.
Well, maybe too late.
Okay.
For what we're doing,
okay,
I'm just curious whether you had them right now in your pocket.
No, I don't.
Okay.
No, if when would you like them?
Well,
I mean, if it's too late, I mean, tomorrow?
No. Or
so,
with the written
so right
comments.
Now.
But that's okay. I didn't make any assumptions that you did have any information. I was just trying to find out perhaps if you did.
Okay. No, yeah. I don't.
Okay.
Also, we did respond to the senator's letter.
Yes, we got your response.
It. Okay.
Basically a mini staff report, and we appreciate that.
We're trying to collaborate.
Yeah, it was. I don't know if it was collaboration or more of it was a how you felt in a singular purpose, but that's.
Okay, we're trying to answer his concerns.
Okay, some of them were answered. I think he just feels that more collaboration and more cooperation is needed in this issue. That it shouldn't be answered today. It should be answered after all these things have been answered and brought forth.
Okay.
I mean, we've heard a lot of stuff today that certainly is new things. So, I appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rutz. Keith Roberts, followed by Kirk Schmidt. Did Mike go out? It did. John? Okay, there we go. So Keith Roberts, Kirk Schmidt, and Stuart Stiles. Oops.
Do you just do it yourself? Which one is that?
Top is forward.
This one's forward?
Keith Roberts, R-O-B-E-R-T-S, Chairman of the Salinas Valley Water Coalition. I'm going to skip past a couple slides here.
Wait a minute.
As Nancy had mentioned earlier, we retained Tim Durbin, a hydrologist. Some of his comments are based on this model that was performed by Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in 2006, excuse me, where they made a simulation model, and the basin area was about 15 miles of the Salinas in comparison of the Salinas Valley. But I'll just read it. The investigators used a soil aquifer model to study impacts of nitrate loading to the groundwater basin for poultry farms, dairies, and agriculture land. And the model scenario involved increase in nitrate loads from all sources of nitrates from 1945 to 1985 and constant loads after 1985, except that the poultry farming ceases in 2045. And then even though the cessation of the poultry farming removes about 50% of the nitrate load from the area, groundwater basin Lagos, the simulation results indicate that very little reduction of groundwater nitrate is achieved in 150 years after cessation of poultry farming. Another interesting result is that nitrates continue to increase within parts of the basin even after the cessation of poultry farming. So this makes it very complicated to align where nitrates come from, or if the nitrates are an issue. It appears that your hypothesis is that farming is the sole contributor to the nitrate load, and this argues that farming is not the main cause. So farming, you can't grow crops without nitrogen. You all understand that, right? Nitrogen comes in various forms. Some of it move. I mean, the soil types. We talked about the. I heard the comments made about the. Can I? One second.
One sentence. Dr. Hunter is going to have a question for you, correct? But finish your sentence.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that. The UC system, Berkeley, Davis, Polytechnic, Cal Poly, state universities, they've all built their models based on laws of maximum, okay? And the laws of maximum is where you can put so many units of one thing, and then that gives you maximum production. And the reason for that was there was a world that needed to be fed. So now you're talking.
Mr. Roberts, thank you for your comments.
All right.
Okay. Dr. Hunter?
Yeah, just one question. The poultry operation ceased in, that's past tense, in 2045. Is that a typo?
No. That's a model.
That's a built model. It's a
built model where they simulated cause and effect. And the point is that you don't have a scientific system that has the metrics built into it to allow to determine whether there's an issue with contamination, how, where, what, it's cause and effect. You've got to establish cause and effect on your formulations before you can derive to any kind of answer for anything.
Okay, I understand. I just wanted to be clear that I got that number right. Thank you.
Yeah, those are correct numbers.
Okay, thank you for your comments.
You know, before he leaves.
Yes.
Roberts?
Yeah.
Mr. Roberts?
Yes, sir.
You took that slide down, but talk about poultry.
Well, poultry is, on that specific area, poultry is manure. The byproduct of poultry is manure.
I understand.
There was a, if you're asking how that came about, it was because it was a given area that was suggested that it was causing nitrate pollution.
Well, I wasn't really focusing on the poultry, but it just triggered that, and I'm not familiar with the whole region, but in Salinas Valley, Castroville, Moss Landing, parts of Santa Cruz County had approximately 400 dairies from the late 1800s until probably 1960, late 60s. And I think I've asked the question before, and I know different soil types, water travels through those at a different rate. And so consequently, I'm wondering, and I'm not a scientist, but I'm wondering, with all you talked about poultry manure, I'm talking about cows, dairy cows, manure, which don't exist except for maybe one or two. Moonglow is the only one I can, and Shock's dairy are the only two active ones that I believe in the Salinas Valley at this particular time. How long does that take those nitrates travel through the ground to get to groundwater? And one of the things I'm grappling with is, why do we hold hostage all these farmers today for the issue of collective nitrates for the last 150 years?
That's a point well taken. I totally agree with you. And this is the fundamental reason why you have to tie hydrology, agronomy, and scientific basis to encounter all the data before you can make an assumption that one individual person, thing, activity, it could be as simple as dinosaurs, it could be as simple as cattle 50 years ago, it could be things that we don't have a clue. And you're exactly right, that the capacity of the soil, it's cation exchange capacity, it's electroconductivity, it's organic matter. And there's a lot of areas that, if you bring in agronomy into play, that will hold materials into place. I mean, what I'm saying is you can make improvements, but you can't go back and change. And the only way you're going to make improvements is to do cause and effect and determine what specific item you need to work on at a time. It has to be parallel hypothesis to prove or disprove to do the cause and effect before you can make any kind of regulatory suggestion that would economically destroy farms, devalue land, and put many people out of work. And the evidence is there are other items that could take care of specific algae bloom. There's enzymes. There's dilution. You can add water. You can add enzymes. You can do things to lower the specific thing. And anybody that has waste charge into ponds has that ability to do it. So why not think on a bigger box and work on the specific areas of influence?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your comments. Kirk Schmidt?
Chairman Young, members of the board, Kirk Schmidt, Executive Director of Preservation, Inc., SCHMIDT. I'm, as you're aware, Preservation Inc. conducts the cooperative monitoring program and the existing waiver, and I'm going to restrict my comments to the cooperative monitoring program as proposed in the current draft. Dealing with surface water quality, the proposal in the current draft is very similar to the existing cooperative monitoring program. There appear to be some changes in sites, and there's an addition of extensive pesticide monitoring four times in the second year, as well as metals monitoring four times in the second year. We've done, with the exception of metals, we've done those types of sampling in the past for the cooperative monitoring program. However, we continue to have a problem with our inability to conduct benthic physical habitat assessment because it requires trespass on ag properties. The current protocol used requires measuring the habitat for 100 meters to 250 meters upstream from the cooperative monitoring site. We do not have access to those properties. Our legal counsel has advised us that trespass is a strict liability, and we can no longer ask our contractors to conduct that type of monitoring. However, it seems that because of the, to be kindly, the protracted length of time the adoption of this waiver will take, that it may be appropriate to adopt a surface water quality cooperative monitoring program now so that we can have assurances going out into the future what the cost will be so that we can determine what the assessments to farmers will be for next year. In order to do that, we'd have to meet with farmers this summer. We cannot meet with farmers unless we know what the program will be next year. The MRP, unlike the order itself, can be changed by your executive officer. And we believe that it is time to start the discussions of what the MRP for the Cooperative Monitoring Program for Surface Water Quality will be for next year, so that there can be a continuity between this year and next year, given the fact that due to a lack of quorum, you have an inability to adopt the waiver at this point. The second thing is there's some items in the MRP that could be simplified. There's reason to support accuracy, but there's no reason to call for additional costs to achieve that accuracy. One of the examples which will come out in the Farm Bureau presentation is a change in the in a groundwater proposal that they have from requiring a professional engineer or hydrologist to conduct the sampling at what will be over 3,000 wells to someone who is a trained person. Indeed, this is the procedure that's used for food safety now, where you just have to have someone who's adequately certified and trained to conduct the sample and not require someone at additional cost to come and do the sampling. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Stuart Stiles. Stuart Stiles. Okay. Michael Taloff. T-A-L-O-F-F. Wilton Webster. Wilton Webster. C.Z. Whitney.
How about Howard Whitney? Is that mine?
There are two Whitneys.
Oh, okay.
He can go first if he wants.
I think you found him.
Are you related?
Oh, we might be. I don't know. I'd feel sorry for him if we were.
Okay.
C-Z-W-H-I-T-N-E-Y. Chairman Young, board members, about 8 years ago, under pressure from environmental and political activists, Central Coast Water Board undertook an enforcement action against two North San Luis Obispo County landowners who cleared some brush from their properties. Yes, there was some siltation due to an above-average rainy season, which followed several months later. However, most of the siltation was more likely due to a large wildland fire that occurred in the same area just a month or so after the brush was removed. Through the ensuing administrative adjudication process, each landowner agreed to staff-recommended mitigation and a $24,000 fine. Your board, however, pressed once again by activists, withdrew the agreement and subsequently fined the landowners $125,000 apiece. What concerns me is the proportionality between clearing some brush and allegations of responsibility for nitrate and pesticide levels. According to your website, fines issued by your board at the administrative level are huge. What concerns me more is that there is ample, credible testimony that the science upon which the proposed order is based is at best incomplete. If the order is adopted as proposed, farmers, operators, landowners, fractional interest holders, and anyone else who might be subject to this order will likely be forced to spend inordinate amounts of money on mitigation, fines, legal fees, and other associated costs. Can the regulated withstand the financial strains imposed on them, or will loss of land, equipment, income, and other assets simply become a path to insolvency? And if that becomes the case, in 2, 3, maybe 5 years down the road, it becomes evident that the order is based on inadequate, incomplete, defective, and/or otherwise flawed science, what happens to those who have faltered under an unjust and unfounded regulatory yoke, and who will make them whole? Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. And now your other half, Howard Whitney.
Chair and board members, thank you. My name is Howard Whitney, W-H-I-T-N-E-Y. I'm a professional geologist, certified hydrogeologist, and I have over 25 years of experience. I've worked on numerous agricultural contamination assessments, conducted field investigations, and numerical modeling of chemical fate and transport. I've also personally witnessed the devastating effects of the blue baby syndrome at an ag site that I had sampled when I was a young guy. And it sticks with me to this day. I fully support the staff recommendation for the water quality monitoring. I applaud the wisdom, courage, and professionalism of board staff to develop these groundbreaking and critically necessary water quality rules. The draft waiver is the most professional technical regulatory document that I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot. And there's a lot of wiggle room in this document. There are some comparisons with point source contamination. Completely different. My clients would crawl over broken glass to get this type of regulatory environment in their fields. However, the current draft represents the minimum level of monitoring to provide any meaningful water quality improvements. So I implore the board, don't water this down. Why? You know the reasons. Ag everywhere produces the greatest environmental impacts to water quality, resulting in countless exposure pathways that degrade human health and aquatic life. No other industry or pollution source is even on the same environmental radar screen. The Central Coast has some of the most degraded water quality in the nation. And it's also not surprising that our region has the most productive ag land. This is going to be very expensive to clean up. I believe that in order for this to be successful, we need a cleanup fund to do this. And I think that the farmers have been misled by their consultants in this regard. This is a very serious problem that requires a lot of very serious work, and none of their consultants has the proper qualifications required under the Water Code to address water quality investigation and cleanup. The professionals that they do have that have presented information has been useful, but it doesn't address the entire problem. 25 years ago, when I parachuted onto Superfund sites, we didn't know what was going on. There was no science at that time. We invented it. There's a whole industry of environmental professionals that are currently working and wasting their time on underground storage tank work that results in almost no exposure pathways, and they can get to work on this. But the farmers need the funding. And Mr. Risk, please have your boss work on getting a cleanup fund established to address this issue, because it's critically important. But the farmers need the money to do it. They can't do it all on their own. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Joel Wiley.
He got detained at a business function design.
Okay.